Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast. I'm Sarah Bankson, Deputy Director of RTP. We're honored to host today's discussion on disparate impact liability, and it's my pleasure to introduce our moderator, Linda Chavez, who serves as chairman of the Center for Equal Opportunity. To learn more about today's speakers, I invite you to view their full biographies at regproject.org. Thank you for being with us today. Linda, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Sarah. And I'm pleased to introduce to our audience two very distinguished people who I've worked with for years and who are both on the Regulatory Transparency Project Working Group on Race and Sex. They are Dan Marinoff, who is Executive Director of the American Civil Rights Project. He's also an adjunct at the Manhattan Institute, and Gail Harriet, who is professor of law at San Diego University Law School, and she is the chairman of the American Civil Rights Project. So welcome, both of you, to the program today. We're going to have a sort of freewheeling conversation. In April, President Trump issued one of many of his executive orders. This one was called Restoring Equality of Opportunity and Meritocracy, which is a big job. And we have gotten quite far astray from that principle in recent years. It starts out by saying that a bedrock principle of the United States is that all citizens are treated equally under the law, and goes on to talk about the way in which that is no longer the case, and that the promise of equal opportunity has become a divisive pursuit of results preordained by irrelevant, immutable characteristics, and rather than individual strengths, effort, and achievement. And it says a key tool of this movement is disparate impact liability, which holds that a near insurmountable presumption of unlawful discrimination exists where there are any differences in outcomes in certain circumstances among different races, sexes, or similar groups, even if there is no facially discriminatory policy or practice or discriminatory intent involved, and even if everyone has an equal opportunity to succeed. Well, that doesn't sound good. And so I'm going to throw the first question to Dan and ask you about this concept of disparate impact liability. And where does it come from? Maybe you can give us a little two-minute elevator speech of the history of disparate impact law, focusing specifically on a couple of important cases, the Griggs case and the Ward's Cove case.
Sure. And I'm rather sure that Gail could also do this at least as well as I can, and may jump in with details that I've left out.
Not in two minutes. I can't possibly do it in 2 minutes. I'll give it a try.
So the Civil Rights Act passes in 1964. One of its core provisions is Title VII, which deals with employment law. To oversimplify a really long and complicated story, the wheels almost came off the act in the U.S. Senate when they noticed that there was a flunky bureaucrat in Illinois who read into one of the antecedent state statutes Title VII was based on disparate impact. And the Senate thought that that was so loony and so obviously not what they wanted to do that it nearly killed the whole bill. So, Senator Dirksen saves the day, negotiates a bunch of stuff. Eventually, the Senate passes the statute in the form, you know, that it exists from then until 1991. It's basically very clear from the congressional record at the time that the Senate only passed this when it was convinced that this was a disparate treatment statute, that disparate impact was not in it, and it would not have passed it if that wasn't the case. So says Congress. Then the EEOC, also created by Title VII to help administer the statute, takes over. And the EEOC has other ideas and decides it wants to interpret the statute more broadly than any other agency was interpreting any provision of Title VII to cover both intentional discrimination and something else, which winds up transmuting into what we know as disparate impact. Once they start trying to read this into the statute, you eventually get by 1971 to the Griggs case at the Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court defers to the EEOC's interpretation of the statute and declares that this was in the statute all along. It is arguably the most purposivist decision of the modern Supreme Court. It's also purposivism that is very badly done, honing in on the imaginary intent of Congress to have dealt not just with intentional discrimination, but with this other thing that very clearly they did not actually have in mind. So Griggs comes down, and this winds up embedded in our case law as a result for a good while. Only in the late 80s do you finally get the Supreme Court starting to express second thoughts about what they've done to the statute. That comes down in Ward's Cove, most clearly. In Ward's Cove, Ward's Cove is a case about a cannery in the Northwest that was sued for having policies that were allegedly both intentionally discriminatory and allegedly had a disparate impact across racial groups. The district court dismissed that suit flat out. The Ninth Circuit panel agreed and threw it out. But the Ninth Circuit then went en banc and brought out of the abyss the disparate impact claims in that case. That is then taken up to the Supreme Court, where Justice White, who interestingly was part of the Griggs unanimous court. So he signed on to both the case that starts this adventure and the case that starts to express reservations about it. He writes this opinion, and his opinion says, whoa, hold on there. You know, now this is going to force people to come in and defend themselves in really expensive investigations who have no evidence that they ever intended to discriminate against anyone. That seems like a bad idea. But that's all just rhetoric in the background, because it wasn't in front of them whether what was actually in front of them was what exactly the business necessity defense was in the burden shifting analysis that Griggs and McDonnell Douglas had created from whole cloth. So in that world, the plaintiff has to show a prima facie case. If the plaintiff shows a prima facie case, then the defendant at stage two has to show something, this thing the court made up called business necessity. And if they show that thing, then you get to stage three, where the plaintiff gets to say, ha ha, but that's a pretext. But if that's how this is supposed to roll out, all that Ward's Cove dealt with was what exactly are some of the factual predicates you need to show as part of your prima facie case, and what is this business necessity defense? It didn't actually deal with whether disparate impact was in the statute, because that was assumed. So, but we get this case, and then the Congress freaks out and winds up passing the Civil Rights Act of 1991. The Civil Rights Act of 1991, in almost every telling, codifies Griggs. And presumptively, that means codifies disparate impact. What I'm here to argue is that actually, if you read the Civil Rights Act of 1991, it doesn't actually do those things. It overruled Ward's Cove. It changes the definition of business necessity. And that's all. So that, like, the substantive section added to the Civil Rights Act, Title VII, in 1991, it's Section K. Section K says an unlawful employment practice based in disparate impact is established if, that's the important phrase, only if other things right here about the business necessity defense. But it doesn't actually amend any of the prohibitory sections of the code. It doesn't change the closed set of statutorily defined actions that are unlawful employment actions. It doesn't deal with any of that. So instead, all it does is it makes this piddling change at the edges to overrule the piddling changes that the Supreme Court had just made. As a result, the 91 Act is dramatically overstated. And I would argue No Congress ever passed, no president ever signed, no code section ever reflected that anything that lacks an intent to discriminate has ever actually been an unlawful employment action under Title VII. You might ask questions here like, why would anyone care about this 50 years after the fact? We can talk about all that. I think the Supreme Court has expressly, if maybe not intentionally, invited such litigation both a year ago and on Friday last week. And that having done so, if we pay attention to the court's precedents on precedents, Griggs is not just wrong. It's the kind of wrong the court actually is willing to reverse.
That was a little more than 2 minutes, but an excellent sort of summary. And I'm going to give Gail a chance in a minute to get into her interpretation of some of that history. And I will point our listeners to an article that you have published on the Federalist Society Review, Volume 26. It's called Disparate Impact Liability, Unfounded, Unconstitutional, and Not Long for This World. But before I let you do that, Gail, let me offer something that you once offered and tell me if I'm right about this. I think you once offered to write a $10,000 check to anyone who could show a job qualification that didn't have a disparate impact on one group or another. Do I have that right?
You have that right.
Okay. So this is, you know, whenever we get into the subject of disparate impact, if you're not a lawyer, if you're not deeply involved in civil rights, a lot of people just sort of their eyes glaze over because this is, you know, very nitty gritty stuff and interpreting each and every course of history in this convoluted idea takes a while and you have to be very familiar with it. But the whole question about what it means, what is disparate impact? You know, what, as you say, what test that any employer gives that doesn't set up some qualification which won't have an impact on one group or another? So explain that a little bit more to the layman, to the laywoman.
Sure. You know, let me talk about what we mean when we say that something has a disparate impact on a particular group. And as you were saying, Linda, and I've said in the past a zillion times, and just about everything. Well, not just about, I will go further. Everything. I can't think of anything that doesn't have a disparate impact on some group that is protected under Title VII. And remember, that's a lot of groups that we're talking about. Every race, both sexes, every religion, think how many religions there are out there. Every national origin group or ethnicity, as we might call it today, that's, you know, hundreds of different groups are protected. And when we say a particular job qualification may have a disparate impact on somebody, well, think about it. Men, on average, are stronger than women. That doesn't mean that every man is stronger than every woman, but on average, men are stronger than women. On average, women have smaller hands than men, and that makes them better at fine handiwork. So if ever an employer says, I want somebody who's good at fine handiwork, it's going to give women as a group an advantage. If you think about it, let's see, Hispanic men are more likely to have the combination of upper body strength, but smaller size on average, that makes them more likely to be championship jockeys. You know, this could go on forever. South Asians are more likely to have experience in the motel industry than others for reasons that I have no idea about. I don't know how that happened, but it did happen. I do know how another one happened, and it's kind of interesting. You know, I don't know if you've ever noticed, but at manicure parlors, Vietnamese Americans are more likely to have experience in the manicure industry. And I know how that happened. Right after the fall of Saigon in 1975, there were a lot of Vietnamese people being brought to the United States, and they were put in refugee camps. And there was one here in California. And Ronald Reagan had just gotten through being governor at that point. And he invited some of his movie star friends to come to the refugee camps to cheer people up. And there were a lot of young women who didn't have any particular job skills. They couldn't speak English. Tippi Hedren, the star of Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds, came to the refugee camp. And for people who are a little younger who might not remember Tippi Hedren, she is Dakota Johnson's grandmother. But she was a movie star at the time. And some of the young women admired her manicure. And light bulb goes on over her head. She realizes here's a way to get jobs for these young women. The training to be a manicurist takes only a couple weeks. So she shelled out the money to send about a dozen of these young women to manicure school. They got jobs. They didn't need to speak English for that. And they would save their money. They paid for their sisters, their cousins. And over a very short period of time, that was enough for Vietnamese American, usually young women, to dominate the industry. And some of those women are probably retiring now because they're in my age group. And you know, it's gone on for a couple of generations. Some of them, I'm sure, went on to bigger and better things. But to this day, if you're looking to hire somebody with experience in the manicure industry, Vietnamese Americans are going to have a leg up on that. Right. And all we mean by that is not that the person doing the hiring cares about the ethnicity, the religion, the race, the sex of the person they're hiring. It just so happens that there are going to be more Vietnamese Americans who have that experience than there are people from other ethnicities. And that's the weird part about the Griggs decision. It doesn't matter whether the employer is trying to discriminate. All that matters is the particular job qualification is such that one group is going to have, you know, somewhat more people percentage wise than another group. And guess what? That's always going to be the case.
And in fact, Thomas Sowell has written many books about this and the way in which certain ethnicities seem to congregate into certain professions. And this is not just a phenomenon in the United States. It's a worldwide phenomena. There are concentrations of Chinese, for example, in the laundry industry, not just here in the United States, but around the world. There are others, you know, who have been involved in electronics or people who've gotten into the computer industry, et cetera. And this is not. So if you're looking for somebody with those qualifications, it's going to have an impact. But I want to talk about something else. We're talking about it all in the context of Title VII. Are there other statutes in which disparate impact has played a role? The concept of disparate impact has played a role. And I'm thinking of the housing area, for example. Dan, you want to go first and then maybe Gail?
So housing is actually an interesting one in that the Supreme Court in the relatively recent past actually did read the Fair Housing Act to be a disparate impact statute, which puts it in a different bucket. Well, I mean, like I would describe this as they're having three different buckets that are available here. One bucket, the Fair Housing Act, the Supreme Court relatively recently said, yes, that is a disparate impact statute. You've got another bucket of the 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause, which isn't a statute, but you know it's also there, an enactment. Wherever we want to say the constitutional constraint on federal power that parallels the Equal Protection Clause, and the justices don't agree among themselves, but at least seven of them agree it's there. You have the two of those. You have Title VI, Title IX. These are statutes or enactments that everyone agrees are entirely about intentional discrimination, and disparate impact is not enough to establish liability without proving disparate treatment or an intent to discriminate. So that's one bucket. Fair Housing Act is another bucket, and somewhere in between is where I would say Title VII falls. But
Gail, let me pick up on that with you, because I can think in the housing area, if you're talking about access to loans and being able to apply to get a loan for a house, your credit history may be relevant. A bank may really want to know whether or not you're going to pay back that loan. And so your credit score might be important for that bank. And as long as it's applied equally to all people who apply for the loan. One would think that would be, absolutely appropriate. But I've certainly heard it argued as, oh, no, we can't talk about credit history, or even in other areas. Credit history can be important, for example, in certain jobs. If somebody is, not good with their own finances, do you really want them to be the accountant in your office, or even operating a cash register if they have problems with their credit, and they have access to a cash register, they, might be more tempted. But, isn't that also the case that you can have what are clearly important criteria, but they get excluded because they have a disparate impact on someone else?
Yeah, it's interesting in that, like, if we really did not allow banks to consider credit history, that would be the end of the world, actually, because the banks would fail. So there are other statutes that cover these sorts of issues, and they haven't yet gotten to the point where you can't consider credit history in making a loan, because, again, like.
But what about applying to live in an apartment? What about public housing?
The case is Texas Department of Housing and Community Affairs versus Inclusive Communities Project. And it was just a few years ago. And they, in a 5-4 decision, a 5-4 decision that I regret very much, they said that the Fair Housing Act does indeed include an element of disparate impact. And so things like credit history there obviously can matter a great deal. And yet, it's going to have a disparate impact. We don't know yet whether or not a court would say that there's business necessity for considering credit history for determining who to give an apartment to. My guess is that they would, at least to a certain extent. But there are all sorts of other things that have a disparate impact, like criminal record. Can you consider criminal record in determining, who to lease the apartment to? Because that will have a disparate impact. It will also have a disparate impact, for example, do you own a pet? It's actually true that, like, whites are more likely to own dogs than members of other races for cultural reasons that I couldn't begin to understand. But it's true. So if someone says no dogs, that's going to have a disparate impact on whites. So many things fall into that category. So we've opened up for now for apartment lease and such, that question of, if something has a disparate impact, does that mean that you can't use it? And if it does, that means that they just have to give out apartments randomly, I guess, because everything will have a disparate impact.
And I'm thinking now, of the question of, say, public housing. So access to subsidized housing or public housing of some sort, not being able to check criminal record is going to have an impact on the people who live in that housing. And if it's excluded, who gets hurt by that? If you basically say you cannot consider the factor of whether or not you've served in prison, isn't it really the other people who live in the housing unit? Yeah. And aren't they more likely to be also Black and brown and poor than others? So who are we helping by this?
Yeah, in fairness, they haven't quite gotten so far as to say you can't consider it at all. Mm-hmm. It's actually the EEOC in the employment area where they've gone the furthest on this. And they had a guidance that they issued in 2012. And they knew they couldn't say you can never consider criminal record, but they sort of danced around it and said, this has a disparate impact, and therefore you have to be really careful. You have to first determine without asking whether someone has a criminal background. You should decide who you want to hire, and then you go to that person and you ask them, can we now check to see whether you have a criminal background? And if it turns out they do and you don't want to hire them, then you've like sent this giant message to them. The reason that you didn't get hired had to be only that you had a criminal record. And they never came out and said, you can never reject someone for that. But they went pretty darn far. They said, even if there's a state law that says, for example, you know, for a particular job category.
Working in a daycare center, for example.
There are lots of state laws. Right. For a daycare center, right. You cannot have someone who has been convicted of a felony, or you cannot have someone who has been convicted of molesting children.
And
they go and they say, the EEOC said, no, that's overruled by Title VII and the Griggs case. And you have to instead show business necessity. Well, you know, any employer is going to panic at this. I have spoken to people who work in the security guard industry. These are companies that hire people, then give them out to other companies, you know, to be security guards. So if you need a security guard for your bakery, you call this company and say, you know, can you have a security guard that works from 6 in the evening until, you know, 7 in the morning to make sure that nothing happens here. And I would have thought that it would be obvious that security guards need to have clean criminal records, that's one of those jobs where you want to make sure the person is not a criminal themselves. And yet the EEOC went nuts and went after more than one of these companies and, you know, insisted on investigating their entire method of hiring. Of course, other companies see that and they look at the guidance, and the guidance is incomprehensible. You don't know what to do if you're the employer and you look at this 2012 guidance. All you know is, boy, I better not reject very many people with a criminal record or I'm going to be in trouble. And the security guard companies now know, you know, even we, the security guard companies, have to hire people who have felony records. And it's really the idea, if you look at Title VII itself, which just says you can't discriminate on the basis of race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. The idea that somehow you can find in this the complicated 2012 guidance. It's just.
I will say, and I will add, Gail, that I once served on the board of directors of a large facility services company that included at the time security. And one of the things that happens is if you can't ask those questions and then something happens on the job, guess who gets sued? These company that provided the security agents. And so, you know, employers are very much in a spot here. Dan, I think you wanted to add something or weigh in here.
I was just going to say that, and I mentioned this in the article, there's actually a suit that the EEOC brought last year against Sheetz. Sheetz is like a Quickie Mart and gas station chain up and down the East Coast, based on entirely on their screening for criminal records in their hiring process. And they denied that it was discriminatory and this was being litigated. It's been in court. I believe last week that the EEOC actually moved to have the case dismissed, and that one of the individuals who had originally complained to them is trying to intervene to keep the case going. So it's an interesting thing to see how this pans out. But like you were talking about the president's order, this is one of the places it's actually having an effect, in that having instructed agencies to deprioritize enforcement efforts, employing a disparate impact theory has actually pointed towards wrapping up a piece of litigation against an employer doing something I think almost anyone would have said was reasonable, but which, by the way, even the EEOC said had no intent to discriminate.
You know, let's talk about that. I was just going to interject, and you can weigh in too, Gail, on this. But I think Dan raises an interesting point. So, okay, there's an executive order that's passed, or not passed, but an executive order that's signed by the president, and it's going to have impact in the executive branch so long as this president is in office. What, though, is going to happen when this administration goes away? Is an executive order enough to take care of this issue, or what do we really need, Gail?
Well, on that, you know, an executive order can be withdrawn at a drop of a hat. I mean, it's very easy. The next president can withdraw every single executive order from every single president if that's what that president wants to do. The thing I wanted to add about the criminal background stuff is that, weirdly, it actually causes actual race discrimination. You know, there is some empirical evidence what happens when employers are told they can't consider the criminal background of the applicants. They can't even ask. They won't even know, you know, which candidates have that. What happens is that they fall back on actual race and sex discrimination. You know, if you hire an Asian female, they're less likely to have a felony record than if you hire a Black male, or for that matter, a white male or any other male.
Right.
And there's some evidence that has actually happened. That's a really sad story. The EEOC, you know, overreaches in this way.
Well, okay, so.
And instead of having, they get the opposite. They get actual discrimination.
So, you know, you're absolutely right that an executive order can be withdrawn by the sitting president or by the next president. You can essentially withdraw executive orders by previous presidents. I mean, this president withdrew the 11246, which was the executive order that mandated affirmative action. And, you know, and that has been around for, I don't know, almost 50 years or so, maybe even more. And so, yeah, it doesn't have the same weight as a Supreme Court precedent, or even more importantly, legislation. So is there something that, you know, needs to be considered in this arena? Is there more legislation, Dan? I mean, you've written, you know, this article and talked a lot about the history of civil rights law, and I'm old enough to remember that history firsthand, for some of it at least. And you're right. I mean, the people who passed the 1964 Civil Rights Act had no intention whatsoever to mandate equal results. And in fact, you know, the famous, it may even be apocryphal, but the famous quote from Hubert H. Humphrey was, you know, I'll eat every page of the bill if it ends up requiring racial preference in order to get equal results. But is there perhaps an avenue for Congress to do something in this arena that can make this clearer?
So, I mean, I think the first thing to say is, yes, of course, there are things that Congress could do. If anyone wants to take a bet on whether Congress will do them, I think you will find receptive odds most places. It is certainly possible, and I would hope that they will, but, you know, if there's any senator listening, I'd be happy to give you some suggestions. Shy of that, the law is actually already clear, and I think we do really need to have litigation in the works to push this through, to give the Supreme Court the chance to actually rule on the issue. And I mean, I see at least three ways that you could get this into court. One would be, we started this journey by the EEOC issuing a guidance document in an area where it has no regulatory authority, can't and doesn't issue regulations, so doesn't have to go through notice and comment. So to unwind what they started, the cleanest, easiest way would be for them to issue a new guidance document correcting their erroneous interpretation of the law. Now, they do that, I'm relatively certain that they get sued by some plaintiff's lawyer, probably in Massachusetts, maybe Rhode Island, maybe Hawaii. I guess I should throw in Maryland too, you know, but there will be someone who sues them about that to enjoin them from going forward with their new guidance. There might be such a plaintiff's lawyer working on that suit right now just to challenge the president's executive order. I don't want to mouth off about whether any such effort would be ripe, but at least after they issued new guidance, I think there'd be pretty strong evidence that it would be proper, given that the EEOC has been sued challenging its guidance documents in the recent past, including the last 4 years, about in the aftermath of Bostock. So we know that could happen. And, you know, that would be one way. Another way would be someone in a parallel position to Sheets could simply argue as a defense, in addition to whatever else they're arguing in the suit, there's no such thing as this claim. Now, given Griggs, you make that argument as a defendant, you're going to lose at a district court, and you're going to lose at a court of appeals almost certainly as well. But you'd then be able to try to convince the Supreme Court to take the case on cert and deal with the issue. I can think of many reasons that a defendant would not find that an appealing option, but it's possible. And the third way that I've come up with that someone could get this into court would be that if one felt that this was an important question and one were an employer subject to Title VII, as a matter of federal law, any time that you could be sued, you don't have to wait to be sued. You can, in fact, go into court preemptively and seek a declaratory judgment of your rights on the same issue. So any such plaintiff could sue the EEOC if they're a private plaintiff, or the Department of Justice if they're a public one, and simply say something like, as an example, let's say the county that runs a jail has an opinion that it would like to screen its potential hires for their criminal records. They might have very good reasons to do that, and they might have every intention of establishing a facially neutral policy that they would even-handedly apply. They do not care about the race or sex of the people. They just don't want people with a history of, say, violent crime as their jailers. They could sue DOJ. They could bring that suit right now. It would be ripe. They could bring it and force the courts to rule on this issue, on whether, in fact, and you know, I teased this a moment ago, there have been two decisions now in the last 13 months by the Supreme Court, maybe a little bit more, maybe 15 months, both Title VII cases dealing with the same language of the same statute that Griggs interpreted in ways that are irreconcilable with it. So the Supreme Court seems to be inviting us to bring those suits. And I mean, I, for one, would like to take them up on the invitation.
Gail, you want to weigh in?
I'm less optimistic than Dan is about all of it. You know, there's a lot going on here. Justice Scalia, in the case of Ricci versus DeStefano, his concurrence basically invited a lawsuit that would be based on a constitutional argument that disparate impact liability is simply unconstitutional. The notion here is that when you're telling an employer, you know, you can't have a job qualification if it works against a particular group, you're discriminating in favor of people of that group, essentially. Mm-hmm. It's race discrimination to have a disparate impact liability theory. And nobody ever really took him up on that. I mean, it's been years since the Ricci case. And the truth is that conservative public interest law firms are spread pretty thin. There aren't enough people working on these issues. And never, to my knowledge, has there been a case that really made the argument clearly. You know, Dan is coming in and saying, well, you know, you shouldn't have to make the constitutional argument itself, that, in fact, you know, everybody has been assuming that the 1991 Act has adopted disparate impact liability, but it really didn't. It just sort of acknowledged that it was out there and tried to limit it. And I think that's true, that what the 1991 Act does, 1991 Act does a whole bunch of things. It's like a laundry list, but this is one of them. And it says you can have a disparate impact case only if it fits the following pattern, and it then, you know, gives some detail. But that only if is kind of interesting. You know, it's not saying you can have a disparate impact liability case. It's just saying if you do this, then, you know, maybe, you know, only if you do this much. But, you know, you could argue, therefore, that it doesn't really adopt disparate impact liability. My prediction is that if it ever got in front of a court, the court would say, even a conservative court would say, Congress acquiesced in the Griggs decision. by using that language. When I start liking Dan's argument is when it's combined. When you combine it with the doctrine of constitutional avoidance, we can make a pretty good constitutional argument that disparate impact liability is unconstitutional, that it's just a very complicated way of discriminating in favor of particular groups. Well, if you can get that argument in front of the Supreme Court, and it's a kind of argument that's I think it's right, but it's also complicated. And the Supreme Court is not always the bravest, you know, group of nine people in the world. It took them forever to say that discrimination, clear discrimination on the basis of race in college admissions, is unconstitutional. It took them forever. You know, we had the Bakke case in 1978. We had the Grutter case in 2003. We had the pair of Fisher cases in the 2010s. And then finally, the case for students for fair admissions against Harvard, they finally said, hey, you know, this is race discrimination. We're probably not supposed to do that. Took them forever. I fear it would take them a long time to say, hey, disparate impact liability, that's not so great either. That's also unconstitutional. But what you can do is say, look, you know, this is a plausible argument under the doctrine of constitutional avoidance. You should like avoid that if you can. Why don't you instead look back at the 91 Act and agree with us that they didn't really adopt it in the first place? And I mean, that's plausible too. And then if you get back to the basic statutory interpretation issue, we win that with hands down. I mean, it's just, I will bet every ounce of blood in my body that Congress, the 88th Congress in 1964, not only did not intend disparate impact liability, they knocked themselves silly to avoid the possibility that the future would include disparate impact liability. I mean, they did everything possible to say, no, that's not what we mean. And yet somehow we went down the wrong road. Dan's argument is plausible that the 1991 Act did not adopt disparate impact liability. It's plausible just on his face. I mean, they didn't. They said if you have the following things, can you bring a disparate impact liability? But when you combine it with constitutional avoidance, that gives it a little bit more strength. And I start having more confidence in it. You know, I start from the standpoint that just because you're right, that doesn't mean that you will win a Supreme Court case. We need to build this case with the constitutional avoidance side to it. And I think being serious about the constitutional argument, as Scalia was, Scalia said, look, you know, we need to consider whether this is unconstitutional. And I can't remember exactly the year that the Ricci case came before him, but it was like, 2006 or so? It's time. I mean, it is time. Let's litigate this.
Let me throw out to both of you, because I think this is a sort of overarching issue, finding the right plaintiff. And Dan, you mentioned, you know, Sheets, and why would you, you know, as a, you know, again, having served on corporate boards, you don't want to, you know, open yourself up to huge settlements and huge fines, huge judgments against you for having discriminated. So it's very hard to find somebody. And Gail, to your point, I mean, I really truly believe that the case, certainly at Harvard, was greatly helped because you had another minority group who was being harmed, that finding that, you know, Asian students in particular were being disadvantaged by giving preferences to Black and Hispanic students was a big part in at least getting people to understand that this idea, this concept, isn't quite what people think is. It isn't about fairness and justice. It is about giving preference to someone. And the whole point of the Civil Rights Act was supposed to be You can't give preference based on skin color, based on religion, based on sex. That the whole point is that everybody is supposed to be equal before the law. So how is it you go about finding the right plaintiff in a disparate impact case? Dan?
Yeah. I don't think, for all the reasons you're saying, that the answer is likely to be find someone who has been sued in a disparate impact action. They have every incentive to get out as quickly mm-hmm. and cheaply as possible. I think the answer has to be to find someone who is an employer with more than 15 employees covered by the statute, who thinks that this is important and is willing to file that DEC action. Or for the EEOC to clean up its own house. The EEOC can do a lot of things. It has a lot of statutory authority. But I think one of those two has to happen. If you bring the declaratory judgment action, the nice part about that is you can seek it for the express purpose of saying, I want to do the thing which I have a reason to believe might open me to liability. And I want to find out now before I do it so that I'm not risking those ruinous fines, the penalties, the intention, all of that. Get it out now on the front end so that you're not exposed to the downside risk of that litigation.
Gail, do you have a different thought or anything to add?
I just want to add what every public interest lawyer knows, and that is getting the right plaintiff is not only hugely important, it's really hard.
Yeah.
It's really hard. And that's, you know, when people say, why haven't you challenged this, you know, law? Why haven't you done this? It's, I need a plaintiff. And, you know, to be fair, that's the way our legal system works for a good reason, that courts have the authority to decide real disputes. They do not have the authority to decide issues in the abstract. And if they did, we'd be worse off. It would mean that unelected judges are deciding everything.
Right.
And so the requirement that you have people that really have skin in the game, that really have an issue that they need resolved for a reason, and not just, hey, it's some law professor that wants to know, you know, what the law should be and wants to argue that it should be this or that. It's important. So, you know, we have to live with the fact that it's hard to find the right plaintiff, but it has to be done.
Well, as somebody who's spent many years talking about disparate impact theory and the role that it plays, and again, having people's eyes glaze over when I would do that or write about it, I think you two have done an excellent job today really talking about it in a way that is comprehensible, not just to our listeners who happen to be attorneys, but also people who are just simply interested in civil rights law. And so I'd like to sort of give you each a minute or so to talk about where you see this going. Do you think that the executive order is going to have real impact? And we've already said that we'd love to find a plaintiff somewhere who can test this more thoroughly in court. What role do you think this executive order is going to have? It certainly got this topic on the screens of many people, but what role, Dan?
Yeah, so look, it's inherently meaningful when the president orders the entire executive branch to do or not to do something. And that's particularly important here because there are so many places like Title VI and Title IX where, to the extent that disparate impact liability is possible, it's not because anyone thinks the statute says it. It's because people claim that the regulations say it. Now, I think part of this order also instructed agencies to rewrite their regulations. They haven't done that yet. I assume that they're working on that. And when they do, I think that will be inherently meaningful as well. But in the meantime, ever since 2011 and the Sandoval opinion, we've known individuals, just people, do not have standing to enforce federal regulations. Only agencies do. So for Title VI, for Title IX, for all the places that regulations are the only way that this could be an issue, the president saying don't do it means it doesn't happen at all. And that's really meaningful for the duration of the presidency in that order. For the other areas, there are a lot of left-wing civil rights lawyers currently telling people, often in group-signed letters, don't worry about it. Nothing changed. We can just bring those lawsuits ourselves.
Yeah.
That's Gail. Particularly for Title VII and the Fair Housing Act. They can, and to some extent, I hope they do, because that'll at least, you know, tee up situations where the EEOC can intervene in order to participate and say, yeah, that's not a thing, but they would have to do it.
Gail?
One interesting aspect of the Civil Rights Act of 1991 that puts a damper on private parties bringing disparate impact lawsuits is that you can get much more in the way of damages if you bring it as an intentional discrimination case. And so what's been happening over the last 30 years or so is that, you know, with regard to employment discrimination, the EEOC is the one that does, you know, the disparate impact cases, and private litigants tend to bring intentional discrimination cases, unless they know they can't possibly prove intentional discrimination, in which case they'll bring a disparate impact liability case. But it's not their preferred way of doing it. So I think that aspect of the 91 Act is useful right now, and that's a good thing. So I think that Trump's executive order is going to cover most of the cases that would have been brought. They mostly would have been brought by governmental bodies like the EEOC. But it is still true, as Dan says, that a private litigant can bring a disparate impact liability case, and they probably will be doing more of those now. But they can't get punitive damages. They can't get emotional distress damages. So it's not their preference. I think we have a little bit of a breather here where we can start figuring out how we're going to do exactly the sorts of things that Dan was talking about. How are we going to actually get this issue before the Supreme Court? And I look forward to working on that, and I hope we can come up with some good plaintiffs for that work. I think it's important. I mean, this is a fundamental issue. We are not talking about some sort of side issue. We're talking about something that's hugely important, I think, about who we are as Americans, that we favor equal protection under the laws. We favor laws that prevent discrimination, that allow people equal opportunity, but we don't want equal outcomes. You know, the only way to get equal outcomes is to have a legal regime that basically prevents people from being successful. You know, one of the things that's always bothered me about the rhetoric surrounding diversity is that, like, we talk about how wonderful diversity is, and then we have a fit when it turns out that groups really are different, as of course they are. You know, individuals, you know, there are all sorts of different individuals. But yeah, every group is a little different, you know, from another group. And they're going to have, you know, people of various talents within that group. But the average is going to be a little different for each group on each thing. And, you know, that should be a great thing. We shouldn't expect that basketball players will look like America in the sense that every ethnic and racial group is represented in exactly the proportions that they are in the population. Nor should we expect that, you know, computer scientists will look like America. The truth is that it's more common for Asian Americans to get PhDs in computer science than it is for any other group. So what?
Makers, right? Like, I mean, like, you could do this with anything. Like, yeah,
anything. That's right. Any particular profession you can do this with. And you know, one of my interests throughout my very long career in civil rights is that, you know, people who have promoted these ideas often think that they are helping disadvantaged people, helping people of color, etc. As somebody who has been around and seen that firsthand, it often ends up harming the very people that it is supposed to benefit. So I think this has been a very good discussion. I plugged Dan's paper. Gail, do you have something you've written in this area you'd like to refer to that people can look up?
Well, I did an article a couple of years ago, but I forget the title now. if I think it's something like, you know, disparate impact liability, you know, is
where did it appear? Where was it?
It's in the New York University Journal of Law and Liberty. But if you just Google Gail Harriet disparate impact,
you'll come up. Yeah. Well, you actually, I have in fact done that, and there's a lot of things that you come up with when you Google Gail Harriet and disparate impact. Thank you both so much. This has been a great discussion, and I look forward to seeing you again soon.
Thank you.
Well, thanks, Linda.
On behalf of Federal Society, I want to thank our speakers for sharing your time and expertise with us today. And to our audience, thank you for tuning in.
On behalf of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.